So today's sutta is one that most of you probably know, and I hope it's not repeating things, but I think it's sometimes good to look at the suttas we think we know and see what else we may glean. So this is the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the two kinds of thought, which I frequently refer to, but very rarely read the similes, but very rarely read through the whole thing. And it is Majjhima Nikaya number 19. And a very interesting sutta, because it actually talks about the Buddha's journey before his enlightenment. And do you know what the word for the Buddha was before his enlightenment? What was he called? He was called the Bodhisatta. The Bodhisatta. Yes, very good. We have some very experienced early Buddhist sutta heads here. So you're quite right. So the Bodhisatta was a term for somebody who's seeking enlightenment. It actually means enlightenment being or something like this. So one who is like searching for enlightenment, not one who's already enlightened. Later on, it took on a different meaning in later Mahayana Buddhism. I think initially in early Mahayana Buddhism, it pretty much meant the same thing as in Theravada. But we'll have to ask our Oxford monk friends about that, because they have a scholar there on early Mahayana Buddhist texts. So the nice thing about this is that it shows us that the Buddha, before his enlightenment, while he was still a bodhisatta, also struggled. He also struggled. He wasn't very different from us. He struggled to the extent that he actually had thoughts of ill will. He actually had thoughts of cruelty and thoughts of lust in that same life that he became enlightened, with such incredible, extraordinary qualities to practice and to teach the Dhamma. So there is hope for every one of us, even if you have outright cruel and nasty thoughts from time to time. But of course, the Buddha was different in that he figured out a solution, and he's sharing part of that solution in this sutta with us now. So if you want to follow along, you can. It is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Thank you, Yerka, for putting that in the chat. But again, it's not a sort of study as much as a sort of discussion. So please feel free to raise your hand at any time and I will come to you at an opportune moment. And or write something down in the chat. And again, I'll come to you when I can. Okay? Ready? Are you ready for the Dhamma? All right, let's begin. Thus have I heard. Excuse me, I'll just pour some water for myself so that any throat problems can quickly be allayed. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. There he addressed the monastics thus. Monastics, venerable sir, they replied. And the Blessed One said this. So apparently this is a sutta, a teaching given to the monastic community that were there at the time, but there may have been lay people there as well. It would apply equally to anyone who is looking into their mind and trying to understand the way that thought works, and sometimes makes us suffer and sometimes leads us in a positive direction. So I'll either use the word monastics or community, just so it can be inclusive to everyone here. So monastics, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisatta, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes, two types of thought. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. So this were the kind of thoughts that could arise. And also I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, thoughts of non-cruelty. So already we can see that the Buddha himself had both kinds of thoughts. Just like ourselves, it's not that we have only one kind. It's not that we always think pure and wonderful thoughts. And yet at the same time, he could see that even though there are these cruel thoughts from time to time, there were still the thoughts of loving kindness and compassion as well. So thoughts of non-ill will are basically synonymous with thoughts of loving kindness. Thoughts of non-cruelty are synonymous with thoughts of compassion, thoughts of mercy, thoughts of non-violence, non-harm, and also thoughts that are gentle, thoughts that are kind. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood this. I understood thus. This thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, or suffering, we could say, to others' affliction or harm, and to the affliction of both, both my own and others' harm and affliction and suffering. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. And when I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. So one thought, hopefully a wholesome thought, arises in my mind when I read this. And as I was saying, we all have unwholesome thoughts, thoughts of cruelty, ill will, lust, the opposite of the kind of thoughts that are actually good for us. And yet, how often do we observe it as objectively as this? So perhaps one of the big differences here, or one of the skillful ways that the Buddha's understanding it, is he's simply understanding this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. Right? Can you see the objectivity there, the lack of ownership? He's not saying, oh no, my thought is so terrible. I am so terrible for having this thought. Right? It's just a simple objective fact. This thought, this kind of thought has arisen in me. So there's not that identification. There's not the making himself a bad person or struggling. Exactly. No judgment. And just observing phenomena happening. And then noticing the consequence of that, using wisdom to understand it leads to suffering. And it leads away from Nibbana. So perhaps as well, you know, having a very strong sense of why we're practicing. He's saying in the beginning, he abided diligent, ardent, and resolute. Diligent, ardent, and resolute for what purpose? Is he just sitting there to watch what's going on, or is he sitting there for a purpose? And if that purpose is very clearly Nibbana, then perhaps it's easier to see how this thought obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. So perhaps this suggests that an understanding of which direction we're going in is really fundamental to practice, into being able to discern whether what is arising in the mind is actually something we should follow or not, right? So, okay, so there's a question already, which is wonderful, and I'm coming to Frank to ask you to unmute.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to know, just on this paragraph, the Buddha seems to know that there was some place to go to beyond where he was. Like, how did he know there was Nibbana?
Yeah.
Never there. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I'm not an early Buddhist scholar or a kind of scholar of the Vedas and the other traditions that came along before the Buddha, but I think the word Nibbana was known in India, in ancient India. And it was actually used to mean putting something out. Nibbana meant to extinguish something. So, for example, a child would say, can you nibbuti the flame? Can you put the flame out? Oh, the flame has nibbutoed. It has gone out when you turned off the candle or the light or something like this. So there was this sense that there is an ending of things. I think that was quite strong in early Buddhist thought. Yeah, it's a very good question because I don't know whether Nibbana was understood in the same way by the various different traditions. There was an idea of moksha or freedom, and there was an idea of being free from sensuality, free from hatred, and even free from delusion to some extent. But most of the other religions seem to stop at the understanding that most things are impermanent, suffering, and non-self, except for cosmic consciousness. There was still something that wasn't extinguished, that wasn't the full end of suffering, let's say. Or maybe they would think that, you know, union with God is the end of suffering. So it's a good question, and I can't really speak for the Buddha, but I think India was a land of, you know, spiritual search, and these were questions that came in people's minds. One of the first questions that came to the Buddha when he left the palace was, before he left the palace, was to, you know, what is the meaning of my life? And what is the purpose? And kind of where are we headed? And then when he saw, you know, the dead person, the sick person, the old person and the recluse, he had this sense that maybe there was an end of birth, aging and death. So there was this concept of something beyond those things. And maybe this is, you know, was very prevalent. But of course, the actual nature of Nibbana, I think, was something that the Buddha himself discovered later. I don't know if that really helps, but yeah, it's a really good question. Is that at all helpful? Or I can't hear you at the moment.
Yeah, I suppose it's not... doesn't clarify for me, but I'm get the impression that maybe he just follows his intuition.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to take the jump, I suppose, and just hope you land on your feet, something like that.
Right, yeah. And like I say, because the word Nibbana kind of meant extinguishment, I think there was this sense that things quieten down, things becoming peaceful, becoming still a positive, that's a positive thing. So the word Nibbana would have that sense of coolness and quenching and a kind of, yeah, calming of the passions and of things like hatred and ill will. And that was already a big part of Indian thought. Yeah. But yeah, following our intuition, I mean, in a sense, that's what the Dhamma is, right? We're able to look inside and actually see what's going on and sense that how we use our mind affects our experience. And, you know, some ways are obviously more beneficial to ourselves and others than others. Yeah. Kathleen, can I come to you? Oh, can't hear you yet. You should receive a message to unmute. Yes.
Am I there now?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that.
No problem.
The point I wanted to make, just to share kind of where I'm at in terms of my own practice, and I don't know if it might resonate with one or two other people, that'd be interesting to know. I find the concept of Nibbana and enlightenment a little bit intimidating in some ways, because it seems like this huge great thing that you achieve. I know it's not that, right? Okay. But it kind of, the thing that would enable me, I think, more to in the moment of the arising of an unwholesome thought to notice that it's there is this focus on, or my desire, my strong desire, and I really do have that, to be as mindful in the present moment as I possibly can, to know what's going on.
Yeah.
That's tough enough for me. I don't need enlightenment. It's tough enough for me to kind of, you know, work towards this thing of being present so that I can be as helpful as I can in this world.
Yeah.
So that's what I would find would give me that motivation to kind of seek this mindfulness in the present moment. So
absolutely.
It resonates with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just it's a spectrum, isn't it? Because there's no way we can awaken to ultimate truth if we can't be aware of the truth in the moment as it arises. That's actually
yes.
the path, you know, the Eightfold Path culminates in liberation. But before liberation, we have to practice the other factors of the path. So absolutely, I think when the Buddha's saying that he's abiding, diligent, ardent and resolute, that is the mindfulness, isn't it? That is being aware of what's happening. And then also being aware of whether what is arising is wholesome or unwholesome, helpful or not. And in a sense, that's a very important part of true mindfulness. You know, right mindfulness is being aware or being mindful in a way that overcomes the defilements, right? It's not just being aware no matter what you're doing. I mean, in secular mindfulness, sometimes they say, oh, just be mindful so that you can enjoy your food more, or just be mindful so you can enjoy sex more, right? So it doesn't have that sense of like, is what I'm actually focusing my awareness on actually wholesome or not, actually helping me to quieten the mind or not. And I think the idea of Nibbana is that we're gradually moving towards peace, clarity and peace. I mean, understanding is a huge part of that. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That's where what we're actually doing, right? We're not jumping ahead to some kind of imaginary concept of a state of mind.
I'm relieved to hear that. Thank you.
Yeah, and I mean, there are other suttas where people ask for advice from the Buddha, like, tell me how I can understand what is the Dhamma, what is the right practice. And he says, whatever leads to peace, whatever leads to disentanglement, to knowledge, to becoming increasingly free, that is when you know you're on the right path. So Nibbana is just a natural extension of that. It's just more and more quietening, more and more wisdom, more and more peace inside the mind. Yeah. So Elvira, could I ask you to unmute? This is great. One paragraph and we've got so many questions. Great.
Hi.
Hi.
One of the points that you made is that removing the self from, like, no judgment about the feeling and things like that. Like, it's just something that's happening to the Buddha or to us, and we're just observing. I heard another nun speaking about karma and how we create our karma by reacting. So exactly the opposite of what you were saying. Judging, reacting, and acting as a result of all this process. And I don't know, to me, it was the first time I've heard karma explained in such a way. And I don't know if I'm being clear now, but like, and she also said that you can let karma just burn away, like disappear, dissipate, by precisely what the Buddha is saying in this paragraph, just observing and letting it pass by. And I was always just curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, they're sort of connected and yet maybe just slightly different slants on the same. I mean, I would say in this sutta, there's definitely a sense of, you know, being mindful and then noticing what's arising. We can never stop what's arising. What's arising is, in a sense, old karma, right? It's a result of the previous ways we've used our mind. So say in the example of sensuality or sensual desire, it might be because of previous experiences. It might be because, you know, we're feeling miserable now and we're kind of craving for feeling something different. Or we've been actually fantasizing, for example, and you can actually generate sensual desire through the way you think. you know, or through what you watch. You know, if you're actually engaged in watching kind of raunchy movies or something like this, then it's likely you're going to have like thoughts of sensuality arising afterwards. So that's because of old karma. But I think it's not just about being aware of that. In this sutta, it's talking about using wisdom, the arising of wisdom that notices what's arisen and notices which direction it's going in and whether that's a direction that's actually helpful or harmful, potentially. Sometimes just that mere knowing of it is enough for these things to subside. But in the next sutta, which we can do another time, it does say that, you know, there are other methods we can use as well. So, for example, if you see that sensual desire is a persistent problem for you, you know, and it is for many monks, actually, or maybe especially because it's not that they've got more than anyone else. It just might be because of the celibate life and because of the depth of purification that they're trying to do. It can be quite difficult sometimes to restrain. And so if that's a persistent problem, it can be helpful to bring up completely opposite thoughts. So thoughts on asubha, which means the unbeautiful nature or the non-sensual nature of the body. You know, the bare reality of the body that smells if you don't wash it, or the fact that the body ages, or that the skin is just like a sack that's filled with all this stuff that comes out of all the different orifices, right? So they can actually put a different kind of thought in their mind to displace the unhelpful thought. And I mean, an obvious example on the other side of things is if you're having a lot of maybe thoughts of ill will or thoughts of maybe judging a person or just feeling generally miserable, we can have thoughts of loving kindness instead of ill will. We can have thoughts of compassion instead of judgment, you know, recognizing that we don't really know what's happened to this person in their life. Maybe they're really struggling with something. Maybe we would behave that way in their position. How do we really know? Maybe they don't have enough support, right? I can't remember the other example I just gave, but thoughts of compassion. Oh, yeah. So if you're down and you're just seeing the negative things in life, you're feeling really depressed, you could bring up thoughts of blessings in your life, things to be grateful for in your life. And if we do this even a few times during the day, you'll start to feel, you start to notice it becomes more more of a habit. It more easily arises for you. It's a practice. It's a training of the mind. So I think in this sutta, it is definitely talking about mindfulness and observing things in a correct way, which is without that sense of ownership and identification, without beating yourself up, but just saying, okay, this has arisen, but then allowing the wisdom to come in, you know, and recognizing there are some mental states that are not helpful. And we don't need to engage in. I guess another of the Buddha's insights here is that there is a possibility for these things to be removed, right? He's not a helpless victim of them. There is a chance for us to change, to actually influence the direction of our mind. Yeah. And that's the newcomer that we create. Hello, Jan. Hi.
Yeah, hi. So I actually had a different question in mind, but I decided that it wasn't very too connected with the sutta, so I switched to a different question, which is also something I'm curious about, which is, so what about, let's say, thoughts that are not really intentional, like thoughts that sort of just arise and, you know, if you identify with them, you feel very bad. If you, know, you say they're, let's say they're bad thoughts. And like, do we do the same thing with them? Do we do anything about them at all? Or we kind of just let them pass, right?
Yeah, great question. Really good question. And again, that would be followed up in the next sutta, really. So I definitely advise some homework after this or some, like, let's say, exciting post-investigation of this sutta. There are different situations for different types of thought. So if something's really persistent and really bothersome, it can be advisable to substitute the thought, and that's what I've just been describing. Other times, wisdom into the danger of a thought and which direction it's taking you in is enough. And that's what's being pointed out here, the discernment and the wisdom. And the wisdom faculty can be enough to dispel those thoughts. At other times, there can be thoughts that aren't particularly charged. And I think that's what you're talking about. Maybe just kind of thoughts that are like grey noise or white noise. Just kind of blah, 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 kind of rambling on and kind of coming and going, but not really grabbing you, perhaps. Is that the kind of thought you're talking about? Or thoughts that might, yeah, maybe they are kind of annoying, but you know that they will pass if you just give them time. And that's also a method in the next sutta, to ignore the thought, to basically not give it much attention and to just be aware of it, but put your mind in a way somewhere else. So it's like background noise. And I mean, that's the method I've used most, I would say, in my practice. I've been kind of focused on something else, like the impermanence of what's happening. And the thoughts are there or not, it makes no difference, really. They're just another impermanent phenomena to be aware of. And over time, just by the virtue of being on retreat or living a simpler life, they just start to fade on their own. So that's another way to do it. But I think the point of this sutta is to say that, you know, it's helpful to know what kind of thoughts you're having and whether they're really helpful to you or not, right? And not to be such a slave of thoughts, just following every thought as if it's very valuable, because some thoughts really might not be, and some thoughts really may lead to harm. You know, things start in the mind first as intentions, they later can become thoughts. And if we keep on thinking a certain thoughts, we might actually behave a certain way. Or that thought actually manifests as a particularly unskillful speech, right? So it's really, there's never one answer in the practice, and there's never a mind state that's the same as the next. So it's good to have a range of tools. Okay, I'll just do the three hands that are up now, and then we'll get back into the sutta, because it'd be great to read through it. So, Joseph, have you got something? His video's vanished.
Thank you, Venerable.
Oh, there you are.
Hi, Venerable. Wishing you well. I would find it so kind if you could help. I think in the West, not having been raised in a culture that has a mendicant kind of society, I often feel like I don't know what my role is as a lay person in relationship to a mendicant. There's a fourfold sangha. So the Buddha, you know, said that his work wouldn't be complete until he had established the fourfold sangha. And so I'm often afraid as a lay person, not knowing what's harmful. And like, for example, like what's something honest, like the idea of like going on a date as a lay person, like should I be afraid of that? Is that like, or like that a great mass of fire? I don't know how to relate. Is kama different for a mendicant than it is for a lay person? I just don't know.
Right. Okay.
So clarity on what is a responsibility. And clarity on, I think, mostly thoughts of sensual desire and thoughts of, what does thoughts of renunciation mean as a layperson?
Great question. Yeah, great question, actually. I think at a deeper level, thoughts of renunciation usually means renouncing the defilements, right? That's the general way we want to go in our life, renouncing things that harm ourselves and harm others. It doesn't necessarily mean renouncing particular situations. It's more about how we relate to those. So going on a date, for example, is not necessarily wholesome or unwholesome. It's why you're going on that date. You know, are you going on a date because you genuinely want to meet a person, because you've thought about it and you want to share your life, you want to find companionship, you value, you know, relationships in general, And intimacy may be a part of that, which is absolutely fine for a lay person. You're not on eight precepts. You've not taken vows of celibacy. And that's perfectly fine. You can still attain to stream winning, the first stage of enlightenment, whilst in that kind of relationship. But if going on a date is just for a bit of entertainment and you're not really, you know, too interested in listening to what the other person has to say, or you're kind of eyeing them up in ways that are demeaning or objectifying, then of course that's a kind of sensual desire that's maybe not actually wholesome, and the other person will feel that and it won't create a good relationship, you know. So I think it really depends where you're coming from in what you do, but there's absolutely no prohibition on anything like that. It's just a very, I think sensual desire is just such a loaded area, precisely because it's such a strong drive and such a strong energy that we have to take a lot of care around that energy and really relate to others with an enormous amount of respect. You know, the whole debate that's actually very welcome, you know, very much more welcome, that's happening nowadays, more than it was in my years growing up, around consent, you know, and around consent being something that is ongoing. It's not that anybody has a right to another person's body. It's not that because you've been for dinner with somebody that that person owes you sex, you know. And it's not that if something's feeling good at some point that it's going to continue to for both people. So it's an ongoing process, and it takes a great deal of mindfulness, you could say, but also respect. So I think for me, that whole realm of relationships, when obviously I'm not involved in that world for a long time, 25 years, I think. And even before I was a monastic, like, for a couple of years, 3 years or something, I was only in committed relationships, one, in fact, because it just didn't feel right to be any other way. And that was through the practice, you know. It just felt so important because I understood just how sensitive we are as human beings, you know, and how much care we need to take with each other and with ourselves as well. So for me, I mean, the more I became mindful and, you know, interested in practice and actually started to practice, the harder it would have been to take these things too casually, you know. That just became, a natural thing. So I don't know, that's a little bit around it. I hope that helps. As far as the fourfold assembly goes, the Buddha did talk about the fourfold assembly, not the fourfold sangha, just a terminology, but I think it's important. The sangha referred to monastics. And one of the reasons that, to me, is very important in the current Dhamma sort of setting in the West is because when we talk about sanghas, people think that there are monks and nuns, but then there aren't. And when that term becomes used a lot, it's almost like it removes the need for a monastic sangha because people feel they have their sanghas already. But actually, I remember hearing it over here when I first came over and everyone was saying, oh, there's a sangha that meets in Oxford. I was like, oh, really? The sangha? I won't be on my own, you know. And then it's like, oh, it's a lay community. Oh, okay. That's fine. That's great. You know, but it's two different things. So sometimes it can mask the fact that there's a gap, especially for bhikkhunis. It's important not to to actually notice, hey, you know, there's a deficit here. It's the weakest limb in terms of numbers. But there's a reciprocal relationship between every member of that assembly, and everybody has their role to play. And I mean, without lay people practicing well, the sangha couldn't survive, right? So you may be developing more the, I mean, it's a different challenge. Obviously, right livelihood's a big question for a lay person. Relationships, the use of sexuality is very important. What else is particularly important?
Right speech.
I mean, right speech is for everyone. Yeah. I mean, I think essentially it's the same path. You know, it's the same path. It might become subtler as a monastic. You asked about the kamma being different. The kamma is different when you break a precept. So if you've promised not to do something, let's say as a monastic, and then you do that thing, that has massively greater karmic impact than someone who never made that vow. Yeah. All right, I'll come to Shirley.
Thank you. This is a Guslam Ham. This is a great sutta. I raised my hand because of something Kathleen said, and she said she'd be interested to hear from other people. And my reflection is slightly different, but it is sort of that it's more in the moment rather than actually striving for Nibbana in the future. Not that I'm saying that's not important to sort of strive for freedom, because that would be great. But it actually, I've been on a little self-retreat for the past 3 or 4 days, and I've been looking at metta, and I've been listening to some talks on YouTube, and the monk was up to saying, well, why would you want to live in metta? Why would you sort of want to go to a different place that isn't sort of full of metta? And I'd never really quite looked at it that way. I was thinking, you know, maybe I should have more metta. You know, I should just, you know, there's this sort of residual thing. I should have more metta. I should be better, you know. But I just thought, but it just feels so nice when you're full of metta. And I just noticed, you know, if there was sort of irritability or worry or boredom, or, you know, or anything sort of coming up in my mind, you know, restlessness, I just thought, why do I want to stay here? Why don't I just sort of develop more metta? So I think this...
Brilliant.
So I just thought, it's not that having these thoughts of sensuality, ill will, cruelty, you know, or even sort of irritability and boredom lead to one's harm in the future. They're actually painful now. And why are you doing this to yourself, Shirley? You know, just be kinder to yourself and just cultivate a few blessings. So that's what I was able to do. I don't know. You know, but it was good, and it was an insight for me, which I hope I'll be able to hold on to. But I just wanted to share that. I mean, it's a bit different from what, but similar in a way to what Kathleen was saying.
Yeah, thanks.
But of course, what struck me on reading this sutta, which hadn't struck me before, was this diligent and resolute. You have to keep at it. Right. And I could do that because I'm in a different setting away from home, and just having decided to give myself that time. It's much more hard when there's all the other impingements. You just
become
no longer so diligent, and so mindfulness is so important. You've just got to keep just watching. Yeah. Just like, what's my mind state at the moment? Is it doing me any good, or is it sort of, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
excellent.
So I just wanted to share that little perspective.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really interesting that the different interpretations, because when I read this, I don't read that the Buddha's thinking about the future at all. I don't feel that it's not present. I feel that it's just the wisdom of what you were saying, Shirley, like noticing the effect of what is arising now and realizing that it's leading to my affliction. It doesn't mean in the future. To me, that's kind of obvious that this is, why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? And knowing that it's leading away from Nibbana, it's that knowledge. It's not that you're actually striving for Nibbana or anything like that. It's just knowing that this is not something to continue. And yeah, there would have been a direct experience of that, of the harm it's doing, absolutely, because it feels yucky, right, when those thoughts arise, especially if we roll in them. Yeah. All right. And also having some foresight into which direction it's going, I think, is really important. So, Rekshi.
Hello. Hi.
Very well.
So I was thinking about, and this is why I'm feeling wired today, because I've been having a lot of proliferation in my thoughts. this last week, and I can see it happening. I can observe it, and then I follow the flow of it, and then I'm like, bring myself back, and it just feels quite tiring because in between all the other moments of doing my work or doing chores or living life, having conversations. And I know what the trigger is because I met up with someone earlier in the week, and there have been thoughts continuing about that person. But I can see it's a cycle from a long time ago.
Yeah.
Those thoughts were happening. And I'm just wondering, how do we manage that in real life?
Yeah. Good question. I mean, again, there's so many different ways. I would say if it's becoming tiring, you're struggling with it too much. That's my first thought. There's too much struggle, too much perhaps feeling of like, no, I shouldn't be thinking that. I better bring my mind back. And that's a little bit too harsh. Sometimes instead of sort of telling yourself off for thinking the wrong thing and bringing it back, you've got to actually instead give your mind something beautiful, give your mind some food, maybe just plant some thoughts of love and kindness in your mind, like look after yourself, you know, give yourself some kindness. Oh, this is really hard right now. You know, all these thoughts are really tiring. May I be well? May I just give myself a chance to rest? May I stop the struggle with these thoughts? May I just accept my mind as it is? You know, compassion. That's what I would do. You know, you know that there's a cause, you know that there's a reason for this to happen. So it's just like you say, old stuff. You don't need to worry too much. You know, sometimes we come in and we just kind of try too hard to control ourselves. We don't quite trust ourselves. Instead of that, maybe your mind just needs some care. Yeah, that's one thing I would try.
Yeah. I think what I've tried different things, like just allowing.
Yeah.
But it seems to proliferate more if I just allow. Yeah. And then other times I've thought, let's just focus. Let's give it the time and stare at it. And then it disappears.
Right, temporarily.
But then it will come back.
Temporarily, yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's going to disappear on its own anyway. Mm. It's just a matter of time. So sometimes when these things happen, I think equanimity can not be underestimated. You know, just notice it. Just notice it. What gives rise to it? Oh, this is an interesting phenomenon. Get curious. You know, don't be too afraid of these thoughts. You're not actually acting on them. No. So we listened to a really interesting talk by Bhante Sujata actually about karma, and about how karma used to be thought of in the Jain tradition anyway as pure action, like physical and verbal action more than anything else, actually, more than intention. Physical and verbal action was the karma, the strongest karma. And then the Buddha came along and said, karma is intention. Karma is action, but it's intentional action. So it's our intentional volition more than anything else. And he differentiated it from defilements, such as anger, which I found really interesting because I always thought, well, anger is, you know, a defilement. It's something really like we should avoid. It's dangerous. It's going to lead to kind of bad effects. But actually, unless you're acting from the anger, unless your intention comes from anger, anger on its own is not karma. So I would say those thoughts on their own are not actually producing negative karma. The karma that you're creating with them is how you're responding. So if you respond with compassion, with equanimity, then you're actually improving the quality of your mind. So don't worry too much about the contents of your mind. It's more important to focus on bringing a lot of love, a lot of kindness, compassion, and letting go. These three right thoughts, right? The other thing about this sutta, it doesn't necessarily mean thoughts. It can mean kind of inclinations as well, right? So if you can actually have a positive attitude to what's arising, in a way you're already shifting the pattern of those thoughts. And then the thoughts will start to subside. Yeah. Hope that helps. I did promise that after Surekshi we would get back to the sutta. So if you don't mind, I would love to come back to Madhu and Nancy. So please do keep your hands raised. I really definitely will come to you. But I just would like to get through a little bit more of the sutta because it's such a beautiful one. And I'm definitely going to come back to you. Is that okay? All right. So some of it's dot, 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 and I'll do the dot, dot, dot for once. Because these are basically the same paragraphs with the thought, with the other kinds of unwholesome thought. So as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. A thought of ill will arose in me. A thought of cruelty arose in me. So for both of these, I understood thus, this thought of ill will, or this thought of cruelty has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered thus, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of ill will or cruelty arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. So passive action, in a sense, just understanding, but then he's saying that that's how he abandoned, removed, and did away with it. So it wasn't so active, it was more just through the power of wisdom than force. And this is the beautiful sentence that I repeat a lot in my teachings, and many Dhamma teachers do. It relates to the last question as well, or the last input from Surakshi. So, community, whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire, they've abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then their mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of ill will, one has abandoned, what is it, the thought of, I suppose, loving kindness, non-ill will, to cultivate the thought of ill will. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of cruelty, one has abandoned the thought of non-cruelty or the thoughts of compassion to cultivate the thoughts of cruelty, then their mind inclines to thoughts of cruelty. Again, not necessarily thinking of this as thoughts. If you're having thoughts of ill will or whatever those thoughts that you kind of wish would not continue to arise are, if you can have intentions of non-cruelty towards the very thoughts, yeah, not, thoughts, I'm fed up, go away, I'm trying everything to make you go away, then you're actually abandoning those thoughts of cruelty and cultivating compassion. And if you continue to do that, it's not overnight. You continue to have these good attitudes, these beautiful intentions towards your mind, towards your whole experience. They will be the kind of thoughts that start to arise. Yeah. And then we have the lovely similes. Just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard their cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that they could be flogged, imprisoned. They see that they could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if they let them stray into the crops. So too I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessings of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So here he's seeing the danger and the escape. Last week we talked about the danger, the gratification and escape, didn't we? And then we have the positive thoughts. As I abided thus, or let's say the wholesome thoughts, diligent, ardent and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood. This thought of renunciation has arisen in me. Not, oh, I'm so good, I had a thought of renunciation, yeah, this is the real me. This is like me, you know, the other one is not me. This is, and I have more renunciation than that person next door. I understood. This thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to Nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body, and when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from stillness. So I'm not translating that as concentration. Samadhi means stillness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness and stilled it, or you could say unified it. Why is that? So that my mind not should be strained. And then the same things happen to the others, the other good thoughts. As I abided diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of non-ill will arose, a thought of non-cruelty arose. And I thought this thought of non-ill will, loving-kindness, non-cruelty, compassion, or non-harm has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or the affliction of both. In other words, it doesn't harm anybody. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, a day and a night, I see nothing to fear. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body's tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from stillness or unification. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. And again, that wonderful, wonderful sentence. Monastics or community, whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of renunciation, they've abandoned thoughts of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation. Then their mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. Similarly, if they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of non-ill will, thoughts of loving kindness, they've abandoned thoughts of ill will in that moment. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of compassion, they've abandoned thoughts of cruelty to cultivate the thought of compassion, and their mind inclines to thoughts of compassion. And this is really beautiful, actually, the different simile here. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard their cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since they need only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was need for me only to be mindful that those states were there. You see the difference there? So the first one, with the unwholesome thought, we had to just like tap it this way, tap it that way. Come on, mind, just a little bit this way, a little bit that way. Come over here, come on, away from the crops. Don't degrade the crops. This is going to be difficult. We get imprisoned. We get imprisoned in the prison of greed, hate, and delusion, and it's going to increase. But once those wholesome thoughts are there, all we have to do is be aware that they're there, because they naturally start to grow, right? And these two approaches relate to right effort, don't they? Right endeavor, the sixth factor of the path. The first one is about restraining and abandoning the unwholesome, and the next one is about cultivating. So we cultivate wholesome, and automatically the other unwholesome ones are abandoned. Isn't that magic? Have a thought of loving kindness now. Just have a thought of loving kindness. May everyone in this room, everyone listening to this Dhamma and participating in this discussion, be well and happy. May they be truly safe. May they be truly peaceful. May wisdom arise. At that moment, if you really say that from your heart, you can't have a thought of ill will. So you're cultivating loving kindness. And when you keep doing this, it becomes an inclination. And because those states, I think, are so innate to the human being, you don't have to do much. They'll stay. If you just notice that they're there, if you're just mindful that they're there, if you dwell on them, linger in them, recognize their beauty, recognize that there's nothing to fear, they will stay. And you can rest at the foot of the tree while your cows graze happily, and there's no danger there at all. And then, because you're not wasting energy and you're enjoying yourself, tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind was stilled and unified. Okay, and who knows if we'll get to the end of this sutta, but this would already be a lot. There's still some questions I'd like to get to. But basically from here, the Buddha's talking about entering the deep absorption states, because once the mind is unified with those wholesome states, in this case, maybe through the power of something like a loving kindness practice, it easily enters into the jhanas one after the other, depending on the momentum of the wholesome states that are arising and the letting go, the power of letting go and the power of energy that's in the mind. All right, as promised, I will come to Nancy and Madhu, and also there's a couple of questions in the chat. So I'll come to those who haven't asked questions already. Nancy.
Thank you. So it's really helpful to say, you know, this idea of, you know, just a thought, that it's not intention, and there's not this intentional volition, like acting, say, from anger or from something like that. So not to, as Ayasobhana says, don't send yourself to hell, right? If you're just any thought comes up, and you know, because that's really helpful. I guess a question is that, and that I think this is like the balance of, you know, the wisdom. And I've heard some teachers say, you know, absolutely, immediately stop, replace, not allowed. Wow. You know, and I get that. Say again.
Poor mind.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, but I could see if there's some strength and the volition is there. Maybe you really want to do that, you know, or go through the five steps and all of that. But there is, I think there's that pausing for a moment to see, like what you just said about when you're in a space where these are just background noise, and having, I guess that's, I'm just saying it to ask for validation, right?
Yeah.
And if there is some kind of, you know, heat or something, some energy to it, then maybe, okay, where this is not happening, you know, not allowed. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for that. That's great. Yeah, I think part of it to me would be how much effort is needed to maybe overcome those thoughts. Sometimes not very much, right? Sometimes we can just look at it and, oh, this isn't very helpful, and it just disappears. But if something's persistent, you know, and it really requires a lot of control, a lot of effort, and it's making you tired and you feel like you're fighting with yourself, then just stop it, you know, focus on something more uplifting. In other words, put the causes in place for those thoughts not to persist. So I think, you know, again, we can take these suttas out of context of the Eightfold Path, but remember there are other factors before right effort. We're talking here about right effort in a sense, right endeavor. The previous factors are about our sila, about our virtue. So if we're finding persistent thoughts keep coming up and we can't just get rid of them, then we have to change the way we are in the world, right? We have to change the way we speak to others, the kind of places we associate, places we go, right? Our friendship, maybe, our friendships. And just look at our sila, look at how we're, what we're actually doing in our lives. And you'll notice that your physical and verbal behavior will influence the kind of thoughts that come to mind. So it's the whole path. And I love this sutta because it is using wisdom. That's part of right view, right? That comes at the beginning of the path. So if we're really tuned into suffering, really tuned into it with a lot of compassion, we're not going to do anything that harms ourselves or others. We're less likely to do that in the first place, whether that's think certain thoughts or have attitudes towards those thoughts that is also really cruel. Yeah? Hmm. But different things at different times. I mean, in a retreat situation where you've got the momentum and your mindfulness is really sharp, you might be able to just shoo off the thought, just brush it off, you know. It might be possible, but I don't think to get in a fight with your mind is a good idea. That's the second arrow, isn't it, you know. All right, I'm going to come to Mel because I think your comment was probably there for a while, and then Madhu.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Venerable.
Hey.
I'm actually going to comment on something else now.
Okay.
What came up for me just then, but I'm happy to go back to that first one, but what came up for me just then when you're talking about the prolific thinking is what I found helpful is if I'm in that place where I really am ruminating and I can't let it go and I can't unhook, is to sort of sidestep and try and get underneath it. So what is the anxiety or the upset that is at the bottom of that thought? And then I've got something to work on that feels a bit less charged.
Yeah.
And then I can get to the self-compassion.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Thank you. That was my reflection on then. And the first thing was, oh, yes, you were talking about intention. And I was just curious about if the intention is good, but the action falls short, what happens to the karma in that situation?
Yeah.
Thank you, Venerable.
Two very excellent points. The first point I want to speak to a little bit, because that is one of the methods in the next sutta. There's five methods: substitution, seeing the danger, ignoring the thought, and then noticing the thought formation, which I think means going back to its cause. So for me, one of the things I do is connect, with the emotion behind it, definitely, and feed that emotion what it needs, you know, give it what it needs, give it some care or whatever it might be. It might be that you're feeling really tense and you need to get out and go jogging or just sit under a tree or, I don't know, divert the mind somehow, or go to the sensations, go to the bare experience of the emotions underneath it. So that is kind of coming back to the thought formation, the pre-thought emotion, if you like. And then the next bit about the action falling short. The intention is the most important. Our actions can be refined over time. Remember, we're learning, you know, this is a training. Nobody has it sussed. And our actions often fall short simply because our expectations of ourselves are so high. But yeah, if you notice a particular action falling short repeatedly, then it might be about getting new skills. Sometimes it can be getting new skills. I mean, sometimes for me, it's about being able to express a boundary in a way that's non-charged or in a way that's like clear and not kind of emotional. So the intention's the same, but there might not be the skill set yet. That's one example, maybe. Sometimes it might be that we need to just work on our actions of body and speech. You know, if there's something you forget to do for somebody, for example, make a point to try and remember to do something extra, even when they don't ask. Something like this, you know, cultivate every aspect, not just thought, but also actions of body and speech. Yeah. But the karma, I think, is not so very different. I mean, I guess to work on our body and speech, we do have to make more good karma. So it's not that you're making bad karma if your actions fall short. It's just that you could make better karma, I would say. Yeah. And then looking at impact, you know, because it's not just intention, right? We can say, oh, I didn't intend to be prejudiced or to say something that was actually racially biased, but the impact was that it harmed a person. So then we can educate ourselves on, you know, the kind of things that will be triggering for a person, or understanding the context in which another person lives. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay, I was wondering about doing metta when you are unwholesome. Does it not work then? Thanks so much for this session. Yeah, again, you know, you have to go with your mind. You have to find out for yourself from time to time. Sometimes you may be able to make a shift, and at first it might feel a little difficult, but after a while you might start to actually get into the groove of the loving kindness, and the wholesome states will just gradually subside. Other times, yeah, it might be too much of a step, and you might need to first come to a state of mind that's more neutral, or at least not extremely charged with unwholesome states. I think a lot of the time we bypass by not meeting ourselves in our afflictive emotions. You know, we don't want to be with ourselves when we're having so-called unwholesome states. We're judging ourselves. We're kind of trying to avoid it. We just don't want to feel the grief, for example. And sometimes actually that's an opportunity to bring the wholesome state to the grief, like to bring the compassion in, or to, get at what's underneath it, like someone said. Yeah, yeah. So yes, it can work even then, but if, the more you practice metta whenever you can, the less likely those wholesome states arise in the first place. Yeah. So just kind of practice a lot of metta when you can, but don't make it something forced. You can also do light metta. You don't have to sit and actually try and go deep into the emotion of metta. You can just have some thoughts. Oh, well, let me just let go for a moment, or may I be happy anyway, or something like that. It doesn't always have to feel like super, super profound to be gradually planting good thoughts. Yeah. Polish up our virtue, as I've read that Ajahn Brahm says. Okay, that was helpful to put the sutta in the context of right effort and how right speech, action and livelihood are other factors to cultivate with specific examples. Excellent. And then, yeah, someone else has said that in Majjhima 20, the Buddha mentions beating down on wholesome thoughts only as a last resort. Correct. If all other methods, e.g. replacing, ignoring, don't work, maybe this sutta might be helpful in regards to that question. So thank you very much. That is kind of the last resort. And I don't think, yeah, I mean, it, like I say, it depends on how much force you're using. I mean, you don't really want to be beating something down. And I think when he's talking about last resort, it really does mean outside of meditation, I would say. You're not doing this on the cushion. That would be just way too intense. If it's that bad for you on the cushion, get up, walk, breathe, drink some water. Calm down a little bit. So I think the idea of beating down the thoughts is to really restrain yourself from breaking your sila, from causing intentional harm. Yeah. So I think we're going to have to stop here because we are actually at 8 o'clock. And yeah, sorry, I was hoping to go to one more comment, but I don't want to keep people late, including ourselves, and also Minori needs to say a few words. If anyone wants to stay on afterwards, I guess I could do another 5 minutes. I'm just contradicting myself. Yeah, okay.
Okay, thank you very much, Venerable, for this wonderful talk and explanations. And as usual, I want to take this opportunity to say a few words about generosity. That is a dana, because giving develops wholesome qualities that form the foundation of our Dhamma practice. And here at Anukampa, there are a few ways that we can cultivate this generosity, this quality of generosity. The easiest way is the financial donation, the one-time donation, where you can get the link from the website and donate financially through a bank transfer, PayPal, some card. And if not, if you can, if you are financially able, you can do a regular donation through your banking institution, like a standing order. And other than the finances, there are other ways for generosity, like taking a cooked meal for the monastics. So for that, you have to look at our website, the dates, the calendars, and then connect with the volunteers, team@anukampaproject.org, and select a date. But if you are staying far away, you can do it remotely. You can order a food and get it delivered. Or else you can do some other thing like volunteering. Check with the team at anukampaproject.org if you have any special skills and time, of course. And then there are some needed items in the monastery as well. That is in the website. There's a list which is getting updated. And have a look at the events and see what you can participate as well. And thank you for being part of this community.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I did want to remind everybody about the weekend retreat coming up, because it was kind of short notice, so we've not got big numbers, but it was a bit tricky for some people to apply because of the phone format. Anyway, you just need to put a plus before your mobile number, and you need to put the international code. So it's like +44 and then your mobile number, or plus whatever. and then your mobile number. Anyway, so that's on the 7th and 8th of March, and that's called Raising Our Happiness Levels, which could be anything, really. It could be generating wholesome thoughts or practicing loving kindness or gratitude or understanding what happiness is, letting go of suffering. So that's happening. There's also a talk I was just writing, London, I think it's March the 14th, and that's at the Sri Lankan Buddhist Temple, London Buddhist Vihara, and that's donation basis, so you can just turn up if you happen to be in England. Most people aren't, but if you are, please come, because I think it's probably the first time a bhikkhuni's giving a talk there, actually, in the evening, and your support would be welcome, but otherwise you can join it online. I guess I'll be putting the link out at some point, at least on Facebook or at this Zoom group. We are actually going to be on retreat for 12 days at Anucampa Grove. So I will be doing the metta tomorrow. It'll be my first morning of silence, so see how that goes. So there'll be a metta meditation tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And then we'll be in silence for 12 days. Thank you, Tristan. Next Wednesday, Minori is going to do the chanting session for you, which is a very lovely session with Minori. But there'll be no sutta or metta meditation next week. So I'll be back the following week with the chanting on the Wednesday and the sutta and the, I think, metta that week. Not sure. You can check on the website. Thank you very much. Yeah, we're just going to rest and relax and let the mind do what it needs to. So, but having done this sutta now, I do think I'm going to prioritize loving kindness practice. Excellent. Thank you so much, everybody. I think I'll have to let you go. I'm pretty tired. So I'm sorry I couldn't get to the very last question, but hopefully you will come next time. So all the very best. Take care. Would you like to unmute yourselves? And remember, your homework is to finish the sutta. There's one more simile, and have a look at the next one as well.